With great power comes great responsibility.
Compromise where you can. Where you can't, don't. Even if everyone is telling you that something wrong is something right, even if the whole world is telling you to move, it is your duty to plant yourself like a tree, look them in the eye and say no, you move.
Never step onto the battlefield of ideas unprepared. Before you enter the fray, you need a plan. And there's no better place to get one than right here on Tactics with host Caleb Colquitt. The Situation Room goes live now on News Radio 1440.
Happy Constitution Day, everybody. Yes, it is, of course, Constitution Day, and I could not be more excited about it. One of my favorite holidays, even though it doesn't get nearly the attention that I believe that it deserves. But it is Constitution Day, and, you know, normally when you see conservative shows, they go all out. They have balloons and confetti, and I have a 97-cent hat. That's about the maximum amount that the News Radio 1440 budget would allow. And you'd think I could afford one that didn't have a green stripe up there so that my green screen goes right through it. But yeah, look at that. So that's fun. I'm probably going to have to lose the hat here. It's too much. But thank you so much for being with us here on Tactics Radio. We do appreciate... still in camera. We do appreciate you so much being with us, where speech isn't violence, tolerance isn't love, and disagreement isn't hate. Three maxims that do absolutely line up with the Constitution that we're going to be talking about today. So thank you for joining us, whether you're on YouTube, Facebook Live, Periscope, Twitch, Twitter, however you're watching us. We're certainly glad that you're here with us, and we certainly do want to make ourselves a part of your day every day, because you want to know what's going on here nationally and in the state of Alabama. But today it is all about the Constitution of the United States, not the Constitution of Alabama, because fun fact for you, the Constitution is the oldest legal document in existence. Now, not the oldest one that we know about, just the one in existence today. So there are lots of older governing documents like, you know, the Old Testament, the Law of Moses. But it's not really being operated under, at least not as a governing system for a nation. So to understand that is to really have some respect and reverence for its durability. We don't think of having a constitution that still has had adjustments made to it, sure, but is still intact and has stood the test of time. Nowadays, we don't really think about that. Some people try to think of it as a dusty old document, which by comparison to other documents, it is. But not because it's dusty and old or because we just haven't gotten our act together and put up a new one. It's because it was made to stand the test of time. It was made and founded on eternal principles. And that's what makes it different. Sorry, I have no idea what's going on here. Sorry about that. Anything can happen on a live radio show. So, anyway, what's going on here is we're celebrating Constitution Day. And one of the things that I do love about this holiday is that we get to come together and talk about those founding principles that I was just mentioning, where we really come together, where this should be the thing that unites all Americans. It really doesn't anymore. And that's the thing that I think is so frightening, is that there was a time where, in this nation, we may not agree on much, but the foundational principles underlying the Constitution was something we could come together on. So, for example, there has always been a section of America that didn't agree with certain political ideals of the other party, and that happens on both sides. But at the end of the day, one of the reasons that they were all able to come together and they were more united than they were now is because there were certain things contained within the Constitution and the Bill of Rights that everybody agreed to. And we could come together on those things, even if it was the only thing we could come together on. But that's not really the case anymore. And without getting into too much detail, we are looking at a country now where there are people, by the way, on both sides that look at the Constitution and the Bill of Rights as basically optional, as more guidelines than hard rules, and certainly not eternal principles that never change. You see, that's the issue that you run into. I'm not saying that we have blind loyalty to the Constitution. I'm saying that once you've researched it, once you've looked at it, once you've thought critically about it, you'll understand that going with the principles that created the Constitution is the right way to go. And you look at the amendments to the Constitution, a lot of them, the Bill of Rights and certainly several of the ones that came after the Bill of Rights, they weren't new ideas. They were basically just clarifying and going back to the principles underlying the Constitution. For example, you look at things like the Three-Fifths Compromise and the abolishment of the slave trade, which is in the original Constitution. Well, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, all those are saying is, yeah, let's go back to what we actually started with. Let's go back to all men are created equal. And you can look at the 19th Amendment, go back to, yes, of course, when we say men are created equal, we're talking about the human race, not specifically males. And so in a lot of ways, the amendments that came afterward that were about restoring people's rights, they were just continuations of that original idea, that original principle. There are some exceptions to that, of course, and we could go over those. We're not going to today. But you look at the 27 amendments, basically all they were going to was going back to that original idea. In fact, that's what the fight over the Bill of Rights was about in the first place. You had anti-federalists like George Mason, somebody who I deeply respect and revere, even though I disagreed with some of the things that he thought. You had guys like him that said, no, we have to explicitly say what the rights are. Because if we don't, then people are going to assume that these things are not necessarily rights in the future. And I think that we can look back and look at the way that especially the left deals with things like freedom of speech, the ability to keep and bear arms, freedom of religion, and say, well, thank God George Mason and the Anti-Federalists made that point. Because there's a good chance we wouldn't have those things had it not been for Mason laying them out and making a constitutional precedent for them. But that brings me to another point here. We're not talking about the Bill of Rights today. The Bill of Rights actually do have a holiday as well. It's not on September 17th because the Constitution was ratified before the Bill of Rights. And so it's important to note that when we're looking at the Bill of Rights, it's not that they're not part of the Constitution, but I want to focus specifically on the Constitution itself today. And I'm talking about the words contained within the articles. Did you know that even if you include the amendments, that the Constitution is the shortest governing document of a nation in the world right now? I want you to think about that. Because it's not very long. In fact, if I were to go over here, this is a pocket constitution. As you can see, very small, pretty big print for a book this size, if you can actually see it there. And this doesn't just contain the Constitution. It contains the Declaration of Independence. It contains George Washington's farewell address and an excerpt from some of Blackstone's books. Very little of this book is actually the Constitution. And that really does speak to its brevity, to its simplicity, and its brilliance. You see, the reason that we have such a short governing document, the reason that it's not long and drawn out and complicated, is because the founders believed in something. Now, they disagreed on a lot. There were very heated discussions about the kind of government that we should have or shouldn't have. But there is one thing that every founder agreed with, and that is, generally speaking, government should not be a part of the citizen's daily life. The federal government, especially, should not be intimately involved in the lives of its citizens, and it should be largely not even noticeable. The only exception to this in their mind was going to be wartime, and only then because it was an emergency situation. In fact, outside of wartime, in the original Constitution, there was no power to tax. I mean, how great would that be? I'm guessing that it wouldn't have made a huge difference considering over the entirety of my lifetime, just about it, we've been at war somewhere. I mean, the 90s, we really weren't, but you go from 2001 to now, that's 18 years of war out of my 30 years. That's a lot. So that's really what it all boils down to, is that they wanted a government that did not intrude upon the lives of its citizens. That government was essentially a necessary evil and should only step in when absolutely necessary, when there was something that the general population couldn't do for themselves. And that is doesn't even mean stepping in to help them with feeding themselves or clothing themselves. That means basically anything that was a public good that you could not exclude people from, like, oh, keeping an army from showing up at their house. Those were the things government was really supposed to do. And because we had this idea of a limited government, that was something that all the founders, whether they were Federalist or Anti-Federalist, or they didn't necessarily agree on exactly how the new government should look, they all agreed that government should be as small a part of the individual citizen's life as humanly possible. Now, we've gone really far the opposite direction now. You look at the way the Constitution was written and you look at where we are now. Back then, basically, politicians got elected by explaining how they were going to keep the government off your back. Now, the way that politicians get elected, and this has been on huge display in the Democrat debates. I mean, you can see it virtually three or four times in every one-minute answer that they give, that they're essentially buying votes. They're telling you what the government is going to do for you, how you're going to get a slice of the government pie, how we're going to take things from others and redistribute them to you. That's not what the founders ever intended. They wanted government to keep men from hurting one another and then basically leaving them alone. And even that was mostly left to the smaller governments. Before the progressive movement of the early 1900s, you barely had a national government. It really wasn't something that was very prevalent on the mind of any individual citizen. And part of that was because of this idea of a limited government, of a government that didn't show up at your front door very often. And part of the reason they were able to maintain this for so long is because of the brilliance of the separation of powers. You see, one thing that I've always found interesting about the left in general versus the right in general is that communism, socialism, all of the secularist-based ideas of how a government should work, they all hinge on one thing, and that is that people are basically good. That giving government all that power really isn't a bad thing because the government is the whole of the people. The government is society. Now, government is not society, but that's what they believe. And because government is made up of the people, people are basically good, and that's why we should have democracy and have people decide what your rights are. Founders believe the exact opposite. They believe that your rights came directly from God, that they could not be taken away from you no matter what the democracy said, no matter what the majority of people said. And because of that, we should stay away from things like democracy. We should stay away from things like a powerful government that had the ability to trample upon your rights. And that's the brilliance of the separation of powers. They thought, if we create a government that is run like a monarch, like England, then maybe we start out with a good guy, and maybe we even have a few good kings along the way. But their power is going to grow, and eventually you're going to find a guy that just wants to do what he wants to do. This was a lesson I believe that they learned from reading the Old Testament. You look through the Book of Kings and the Book of Chronicles, the Northern Kingdom had no good kings, and the Southern Kingdom, or the Kingdom of Judah, they occasionally had a good king. You had Hezekiah, Josiah, Solomon, David. After those four, it gets real hard to name any of the good kings of Israel. And because of that, I think that they understood that giving one human being that much power is just not a good idea. And that's why they came up with the separation of powers. See, they assumed that human nature was bad, whereas communism, socialism, general progressivism, it assumes that people are generally good, and that even if they have the opportunity to be lazy, or even if they have the opportunity to not work and take advantage of the system, that they're not going to. And even if you have somebody that has as much power as somebody like Stalin, or Lenin, or Maduro, or Chavez, that they're not going to take advantage of those people. Except they always do. Because human nature is not that benevolent. I wish it were, but it's simply not. And that's the beauty of this separation of power. They said, you know what? People are jealous and people do want power for themselves. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to split the government into three different branches. And the only way one branch can gain power is if they steal it from somebody else. And what we'll do is, we'll have it to where they won't give that power up because they want to keep it for themselves, and by each branch at the same time trying to keep their own power for themselves, then we won't have one branch amassing too much power. Here's the thing that the founders did not foresee, or at the very least, were not able to figure out a solution for. Maybe they foresaw it and just couldn't come up with a way around it. I mean, they knew this thing was fragile. They knew this thing was experimental. When they asked Benjamin Franklin what form of government they had created at the Constitutional Convention, he said, "A republic, if you can keep it." They didn't think it was going to last this long, to be perfectly honest. You can tell by their personal writings that they were hoping to get a good 50 years out of it, if that. They knew that this was a radically different form of government than had ever been tried before. And with the separation of powers, that is one of the key things that has allowed it to last as long as it has. Because human beings are naturally jealous and don't want to give up power and authority. And because of that, each branch was guarding its own power and looked out for its own self, therefore keeping those powers away from the other two branches. But this is the thing that the founders were not able to find a workaround for. That one branch would find sympathy for the cause in one of the other branches and just give their power up to the other branch. Unfortunately, this is how government bureaucracy at the federal level has gone awry. Because you'll have, for example, the Congress come together and create a executive agency like the FDA or the CIA, even though CIA does have some legitimate constitutional backing because it is a law enforcement agency, but the FCC, organizations like that. And then they'll just sort of, to the EPA, for example, make a general statement like, "Make water clean." And then they give that authority over to the Environmental Protection Agency. They allow those people to decide what clean water is and decide the practice that will create clean water. And so they effectively hand their legislative pens over to a member of the executive branch that is not elected, that is not accountable to the people, and often stays between presidential terms, and it's very hard to get rid of them. You see, when people talk about the deep state, that's the real deep state. I'm not talking about tinfoil hats and conspiracies. I'm not talking about sleeper agents of the Obama administration lying in wait and trying to sabotage the Trump administration, although there's probably at least some element of that. You want to talk about the real deep state? The real deep state is the bureaucracy embedded in the executive branch that has effectively the powers of the legislative branch, which Congress just instead of jealously keeping its power the way the founders predicted, just said when their guy was in office, yeah, we'll just give you all that authority. And that's the problem that we're running into. We have forgotten the ideas of federalism. We have ignored keeping power local, keeping power small, keeping the federal government out of your life. And that is why they have amassed this kind of power. The truth is, there is no federal power for a lot of these government agencies to do what they do. But Congress wants that power, and so they create it out of whole cloth, and then they give it away to the executive branch. So you effectively, having an agency within the executive branch doing the job of all three of the other branches, because what they do is they write the legislation, or the rule, the policy, they write the regulation, and then they are in charge of enforcing said regulation. And when anybody asks about it, they also interpret their own legislation and regulations. Because when you ask, well, what is clean water? Well, Congress leaves that up to them to decide. When they ask, well, what is an acceptable level of clean water? Congress leaves that up to them, and so they get to interpret it as well. This is the biggest problem with our country. It's the reason that we have ridiculous levels of spending. It's the reason that our federal government is not smaller and less obtrusive than it is. It's the reason that people lie awake at night and worry about who the president is, because they know that he's the one in control of those individual agencies. And so sadly, what has happened is you have Congress, which by the design of the founders should have been in several ways the most powerful of the three branches, is now by far the least powerful, because they have given all of that power over to the executive and over to the judiciary. Because the only check that remains on the federal bureaucracy, on the agents of the executive branch, are the courts. And even the courts in a lot of situations believe in the doctrine of Chevron deference. In other words, they defer to the experts in their given field over at the EPA or the FCC or these other government agencies. They defer to their expertise in order to handle that and to define these terms and define what Congress actually meant. It's a really broken system. And yet it has still survived this long. How? Because it was part of the design of the Constitution. You see, I find it interesting that so many people that I meet, especially the ones that kind of pay attention to politics but don't really dive into it, one of their primary gripes is they just never get anything done. Congress never gets anything done. Presidents get elected and they have all these campaign promises and they never actually get anything done. It's just the government isn't actually doing things. But what's hilarious about that is, yeah, that's how they designed it. The fact that you have to have a majority of the House and a majority of the Senate, or a supermajority in some cases, and the presidential signature, the fact that you have to have all of that, that is because they designed the system to be slow and clunky. See, the American Constitution is kind of like a tank. Can't move real fast, but it can take a lot of punishment. It can take a lot of hits, a lot of bullets. Now, it's not invincible. It's not immortal. It is still a governing document that was penned by the minds of mortal men that were imperfect. It's not divine intervention, although I think that there was probably some providence involved. And the founders believe that. They even put it in the Declaration of Independence. But the point is, the reason that the Constitution is so effective that it has been able to stabilize the country when other nations around us were freaking out and panicking and having to go through different revolutions and go through different stages of new governing documents, and we haven't, is because they designed it to be slow. Because if you're moving slowly, you can see clearly the way ahead. That's the thing about moving slowly. And as long as the government can't move too quickly, it's a lot harder for it to make stupid or rash or emotionally driven decisions. This is just one example. It's certainly not the only one. But this is the reason that it's so moronic that people constantly complain about the gun debate. And they'll say, well, we need to go ahead and make these decisions now while a tragedy has just occurred, so it's fresh in our mind and so we have some momentum. That's the worst possible time to make a decision. And the founders understood that, and that's why they made the system the way that it was. That's why they wrote this into law the way that they did. It is a brilliant and elegant system, specifically because of its simplicity and because it forces you to move slowly and think about what you're doing before you do it. We have a truly amazing governing document. We'll be back in just a second.
Hey, where are you going, champ? Slugger?
Hey, cowboy.
Where are you going?
Where are you going?
I'm going out!
Hey, everybody. It's Caleb here, and I was just driving through South Alabama. I had a couple quick thoughts that I'd like to share with you. First of all, I really love it when the environmentalists tell us that there just are not enough trees, that we're killing all the trees, that there are no trees out there. As you can probably see through the window there, South Alabama is just trees. There's virtually nothing. You got maybe Andalusia, Enterprise, and Dothan, and trees. And that's pretty much it, other than Gulf Shores, which is the beach. So I genuinely believe that it should be part of our criminal justice system that any liberal that whines too much about there not being enough trees, that their sentence, their punishment for that, should be to drive through South Alabama, because they will be immediately disillusioned about this idea that there are just not enough trees left in the world. There is nothing but trees for miles and miles and miles and miles. Another thing that I wanted to bring up, and it actually made me hearken back to a comment that was made, I would say a few months ago, by Hillary Clinton, talking about how the coast, in other words, the people in California and Oregon and Washington and then New England, that they all voted for her and everybody else voted for Trump, which, you know, is true. And then she also talks about trying to essentially explain why that is. She says that, well, all the dynamic people, all the movers and shakers and the people that are making money, those are the ones that voted for me. It was the neophytes, the little people over in flyover country that voted for Trump. And goodness knows that I'm not the world's biggest Trump supporter. I didn't even vote for the guy in the first election. But one of the reasons that she lost that election in the first place, and one of the reasons that Americans in general are just so tired of that, is because there is a large contingency of the left that genuinely believes that only people in the cities are the ones that are dynamic and important. And I'm driving through South Alabama, and right now it's mostly just trees, but especially when you get a little bit further north, I was driving through here and I noticed there's so many fields with cattle and hay, and you get a little bit further south and you're going to see an awful lot of cotton and peanuts and some soybeans. And so I really do think, and I think that this is important to remember, that though there are people in the cities that tend to vote Democrat and have never seen a farm, have never been through, quote unquote, the flyover country, I think it's incredibly important for us to remember that, yeah, they may look their nose down at people like that, but if you were to actually take one of those people and have them try to survive in an environment where there were not the people producing their food and their fiber in states like Alabama, that those cities would immediately devolve into chaos and die. And I think it's so hilarious that the people in cities look down their nose at people in the country, people in farmland, that kind of thing, and then they wouldn't even be able to begin to have a similar lifestyle that they do if it were not for those people. And maybe I'm thinking about this because I'm an ag major and state convention for the Alabama FFA is coming up. But what it really all boils down to is that whether they appreciate it or not, whether or not they understand the relationship between their life and what they're doing and people in places like this that provide the lumber for the house that they live in or the building that they work in and provide the cotton for their clothes and provide the food that goes on their table. They would quickly learn an appreciation once that stuff went away. Once they realized that the magic bread fairy doesn't just bring bread to the supermarket, that there are people involved in the growth and production and transportation of that, I think it would really paint it in a different light. And what I mean by that is, I don't think that it's productive for us to go out and talk about how silly and stupid they are and how ridiculous their position is on that, even though there's some truth to it. I think we do better catching more flies with honey than vinegar and explain to them and talk to them and educate them about the important role of Middle America to the rest of the world, to the rest of the economy, because the reason that we are an economic powerhouse, the reason that we have so many people that don't have to be involved directly in growing their own food and wondering where their food's going to come from one day to the next, the best way to do that is through education and helping them to understand that that is an important part of it. So let's just try to come at it from a diplomatic perspective, and hopefully they'll be able to realize at that point that it's important for them to appreciate the American farm.
And welcome back, everybody, to our big Constitution Day special. And just so you know, we didn't get a chance to get to this today, and I know I've had people asking me about it, about the House passing the Equality Act. First of all, I don't think that it's super urgent that we talk about it, just because I don't think this thing has a prayer of passing in the Senate. I mean, I don't have a lot of faith in Mitch McConnell, but I think even he isn't going to touch that with a 10-foot pole. Could be wrong, but I don't think that he's going to. But nonetheless, I do think that at least the idea behind it is important, because it could pass one day. And that's why I've decided to bring in an expert. Matt Clark is going to talk about it tomorrow. I could talk about it myself, sure, but he'll be able to talk about it a little bit more specifically. The organization he's with, the Foundation for Moral Law, actually put out a memo to the various senators and House members explaining why it would be a bad idea to vote for this thing. And so he's going to be here to give you a little bit more detail, a little bit more expertise tomorrow. So be sure to check that show out tomorrow on the program. Now, speaking of the Constitution, even though this is going to the Bill of Rights, not specifically the body of the Constitution, which has been our focus thus far today, Alabama has proposed a new red flag law. And I know that everybody is going to be really baffled by this, and goodness knows, when I saw it the first time, I was pretty taken aback too. But there is a good reason why this red flag law is very different, and when you have ruby red Alabama, which loves some gun rights, why they would be proposing this and why this at least has a chance of passing. So I'll explain why this is a very different red flag law than the one that we're accustomed to. So it is being sponsored, actually, by Republicans, which, granted, the Republicans in Alabama aren't too conservative, so I guess it wouldn't shock people if it were a traditional red flag law that was being put forward. And you also have our Republican president, Donald Trump, now coming out in favor of red flag laws, which is, I mean, just wrought with all kinds of difficulties, but I won't get into the national red flag laws. The one I'm talking about specifically is the one that is being proposed here for Alabama, and it specifically has to do with gun suicides. So what this is aimed at doing is not at preventing gun suicides by confiscating the guns of law-abiding Americans. And I have always said I am willing to hear proposals that might actually solve some problems that are targeted not at law-abiding citizens, but at taking guns away from people who don't need them. And by need, I don't mean you have to justify that need. I'm just saying that people that have had some reason to show you they cannot be trusted with their Second Amendment rights, criminals, violent offenders, that kind of thing. Well, this one is specifically trying to prevent suicides by restricting access to gun to certain people. And the ban would last only 21 days. In other words, you get put on a no-buy list. But that no-buy list only lasts for 3 weeks. Because when somebody's dealing with suicide, they, you know, may be able to not get over it in 21 days. I mean, that can take years of therapy. But if somebody is struggling with really serious clinical depression or whatever it is, they might need a firearm at some point. And so the period you would have to refresh putting your name on the buy list every 21 days, it's not something that would linger for years and years, which A is helpful because there are a lot of red flag laws being proposed in more liberal states, and there have been proposals about this at the national level, that once you've either willingly or forcibly been committed to some kind of mental health institution, that you would just lose your right to have a firearm. I remember that back in the Obama administration, one of the things that never came to fruition but was being talked about within the Obama administration is that they would like to see legislation that got rid of a person's right to keep and bear arms if they had ever undergone psychological treatment. Well, I mean, psychological treatment, how broad do you want to go with that? And one of the situations that I specifically outlined is, let's say that there was a woman that was the victim of sexual assault or rape. You would imagine that such a person had probably gone through some counseling. Would that person then be barred from having a firearm, which they may need to help them feel safer because they're worried that something like that could happen again? And so you can see why there's all kinds of issues that crop up when you have a third party telling somebody, no, you've had a history of mental illness, and we're going to take away your firearms as a result. Now, if we're talking about somebody that has a long, consistent record of mental illness, and with that has a criminal record of violence, I understand where you're coming from and can kind of get on board with that. But if you use too broad a definition, and this is the reason why you have to be really careful when wading into this territory, you could have a situation like I just described with a woman that's the victim of rape or sexual assault. You could also have soldiers, which are very well trained in firearms, and if anybody should be handling it, it would be them, that might have PTSD or have had to go to treatments for that, or maybe even went to treatments even if they didn't have PTSD, but they just needed to talk to somebody about some things. What if you had somebody that had just gone to marriage counseling? I mean, this is the issue that you come into, is that, and this is the reason that you generally don't trust Democrats when they talk about their gun measures, is because all you have to do is broaden that definition just a little, and you will be restricting a constitutional God-given right to millions of Americans. Here's the reason I don't think that that's as big an issue with this red flag law, though, that is being proposed in Alabama. The only person that can submit your name to that no-buy list for that 21-day restriction is you. That's it. Not a family member, not a police officer, you. Now, if you've been shown to be a violent threat to yourself or others, there are certainly other state and national laws that could bar you from having a firearm, but this one specifically only focuses on people that are saying, you know what, I've had suicidal thoughts, I don't even want the temptation of being able to go and buy a gun, I don't trust myself with that. And so because of that, to protect my own life, I will voluntarily put my name on a no-buy list. And because of that, because it is something that it is a self-imposed restriction, I have far less issues with the liberty because it requires the consent of the person whose liberties would be restricted to them. I think that you could still, on a technical level, argue that, well, it's an inalienable human right, so not even that person has the ability to remove that right from themselves. Certainly have the right to not exercise it if they choose not to, in the same way that a person, just because they have a thought in their head, doesn't mean that they have to engage in free speech. They're allowed to keep it to themselves and not exercise it if they want to. But it's a whole different ball of wax for that person to forcibly say, no, no, take that right from me. So I don't see as many issues. I think if you want to get really technical and really philosophical, you might could make that point. But I just don't see nearly as many issues with the person's freedom when they're the ones doing it to themselves. But I will say this. I've known a few people that struggle with really bad depression. And I think that it's perfectly reasonable and healthy that they don't trust themselves with certain abilities, with certain, for example, in this with the guns, that they don't necessarily trust themselves around firearms. That's a healthy attitude to have, that they're saying, I don't even want to tempt myself, so I don't need to be around things that I could use to bring harm to myself. That's actually a pretty good instinct, and one that even has a basis in the Bible. The scripture tells us that if there are things that are causing us to sin or do evil to ourselves, then we need to remove ourselves from said situation. I'm of course paraphrasing. It would take a lot longer to explain that principle biblically, but I even understand that. But there are some problems that I do have with this bill, and there are some reasons I think that are perfectly legitimate to oppose it. And here they are. I'm not, again, saying that I am completely against this bill or that anybody that doesn't oppose this bill, that wants this bill to pass, is wrong. I'm just pointing out the flaws. So first of all, a slippery slope argument does make sense here. There is legitimate concern that by putting this bill into place, that it's not that much of a leap for somebody to extend the waiting period or to extend the definition or to extend, and this is the really big concern, the kind of people that can put your name on that no-buy list. Because what if they said, if they already have the law in place, they're saying, look, we're not having any problems with it, but really, a person that lives with that person, they would know better than that person himself if he's actually having suicidal thoughts. So maybe like a spouse or an adult child, maybe somebody that's actually living in the house with them, they should be able to put that person on a no-buy list. And see, then you are getting into a violation of liberty. You're getting into a violation of that person's God-given rights by another person. So I do think the slippery slope argument does have some credibility here. And this is really my main gripe with it, even more so than the one that I just brought up, because it's a concern, but it's not one that will necessarily happen. I don't think this is going to save anybody. I don't. I don't see a reason. I've not been given a compelling argument for how this is actually going to help people that are struggling with suicidal thoughts. And here's why. Most people that commit suicide, they don't even tell their close family members that they're having suicidal thoughts. They don't even tell their spouse, their children, their coworkers. A lot of times, not every time, a lot of times they don't tell anyone. And you think that they're going to take that a step further and go to somebody to tell them to put their name on a registry to be put on that no-buy list. I don't buy that. I'm not saying that it's impossible, and if it does happen and it saves that person's life, great. But I don't foresee that scenario coming to fruition. Maybe I'm wrong, but considering most people that do commit suicide, they don't even tell the people around them, I kind of doubt they're going to go to some complete stranger and say, look, I don't trust myself with the ability to own a gun, so please put me on a no-buy list. And if they do, if the suicidal person does tell someone, I would, for example, if someone came to me, a buddy of mine that's also a gun enthusiast, and said, look, man, I'm having some real struggles here, and I'm not sure that life's worth living anymore. If they did that and they were serious as a heart attack and I could tell that they were really having these kinds of struggles, I would take that responsibility upon myself to say, do you want me to hang on to your firearms for you? You want me to store them at my place for a while? I mean, that would be the next course of action, in my opinion. And so because of that, I do want to really emphasize this. I think that because that option is there, and if they do tell somebody, and they're more likely to tell somebody close to them, that base is kind of already covered, or it certainly should be covered. And if I were the person that were having these thoughts, I would certainly ask that person, since I don't trust myself with it, is it all right if I take my gun over to your house for a while? And that brings me to another point. it's very rare that someone actually goes out and purchases a firearm to kill themselves. Normally, they use what's around them, be that a gun or something else. It's just not a common occurrence that somebody actually goes out and makes the purchase of a firearm specifically to kill themselves. I'm not saying it never happens. I don't know what the stats are on it. I don't even know if stats exist on that. None that I could find, personally. But I don't see any reason to believe that people are going out and buying guns. And part of the thing that they actually brought up in an AL.com article that sort of brought this to my attention is that, well, look at the high rates of gun crime in the state of Alabama. Or sorry, not gun crime, gun suicides. Which the point that they were making is this is a big problem in our state. And by the way, it is. Not saying that they're wrong on that. But they're kind of making the point why the gun is not the issue. We don't have a ridiculously high suicide rate compared to other countries. The U.S. doesn't. In fact, we're 27th. I talked about this not long ago when people were talking about gun suicides. I think it was after Beto O'Rourke. We're 27th in the world, and all 26 countries have way less guns than us. All of the ones that are ahead of us. If people want to destroy their lives, as sad and tragic and horrible as that is, they use what's around them. The fact that there is not a gun in the house is not going to stop them from doing that. That's the reason you have a country like Japan with virtually no gun ownership that has a ridiculously high rate of suicide. The gun is not the problem. And that same AL.com article actually, ironically, kind of made that point accidentally. One of the lines in there with the person that they interviewed that had had suicidal thoughts in the past, one of the things that he brought up was, I was scared to go into the kitchen because I didn't trust myself around the knives. Yes, exactly. Because somebody that is in that mindset, they're thinking about different ways that they could go ahead and end it. And the fact that there isn't a gun in the house doesn't mean there aren't ways to kill yourself within that own house. Again, I'm all for helping these people as much as humanly possible. I mean, being an employee here, I've actually had to take suicide prevention classes. And so this is something that I wouldn't get anywhere close to calling myself an expert on. But I'm saying I'm all in favor of reaching out and helping people in any way that we can, including the removal of things that they might use to hurt themselves, if that's something that helps them. I'm just saying that putting yourself on a no-buy list isn't really something that's going to do that, at least not from anything that I have seen in that. I just don't see how it's going to help them. And so it's not really so much an issue of I think that it's a bad law. It's just that I don't think it's a viable law, or it's not a law that's actually going to help anybody or do anything productive. That's really my big issue. Because since it is self-imposed, I don't think that it's going to do that, but I also don't think it's going to do any good either. And since I don't think that it's really going to do any good, I don't want to risk the slippery slope situation that we just discussed, where people will just expand the existing law to include other people other than the person themselves. And when you look at the United States, United States ranks first in gun ownership, not even close. We are by far and away the most. In fact, it's a 2-to-1 ratio. The second, I think it's Sweden. I could be wrong. I'd have to look at my stats. But the second highest country, the country that ranks second in gun ownership, has about 60 guns per 100 people. We have 120 guns per 100 people. We have more guns than we have citizens, and that's just the ones that we know about. There's no telling how many more we have, that there's no way to really estimate how many firearms we have in our possession privately in this country. And yet we're not even close to the top when it comes to suicide rates. This is an issue with a flawed worldview, a flawed way of thinking. It's true of suicides, it's true of crimes. It's not about the object. It's not about the physical thing. You want to fix suicides, that is a noble goal, and I'll do anything I can to help you out on that. But we have to realize what this is a real problem about. What is the core issue underlying it? We have a dearth of purpose because we have abandoned God in so many ways in our society. People no longer feel as though their life means anything. And as horrible as it is to say, when you've trained somebody from their youth up to tell them that essentially you're just a meat sack riding on a rock through space and there's really no more significance to you than that, is it any wonder they feel like their life doesn't really have meaning or purpose or doesn't really matter to people? Is it any wonder that people feel like, well, really, I'm just a burden and I would be better off if I weren't here? Is it any wonder that they have those feelings when they've been raised that way? Teaching people that there is a all-powerful, all-knowing God that loves them, that created him specifically for a purpose to serve on this earth. And we don't always know what it is until much later in life. But the point is that purpose is there. And that God cares about them intimately in a way that no other being can. That's how you instill a sense of purpose in people. That's how you end the suicide crisis. If we want to address this problem, that's where we've got to start. Let's go to the Daily Dose of Stupid.
That was stupid.
I know it was stupid.
Really stupid.
Hey, I just said it was stupid.
And for today's Daily Dose of Stupid, brought to you by the state of California. That's right, the state of California is our source for the Daily Dose of Stupid today. And this one specifically relates to California's ban on travel to Iowa. Yeah, that's where we are now. That California, now they're not saying that no Californian can go to Iowa because there would be no way to enforce that. They're saying that no state dollars, local government dollars can go to funding a trip that ends in a trip to the state of Iowa. It's a really strange travel ban. If you want to talk about travel ban, that would be a travel ban. But it's a really strange rule. But here's the thing that I thought was weird about it. That assumes that people actually want to go to Iowa. There's nothing in Iowa to see. It's just cornfields. But one thing that's really odd about that, maybe the only reason that they do want to go to Iowa is because it's 1,000 times better than California. I mean, the weather's probably not nearly as nice. But, I mean, come on. Living in California, the heart of progressivism, I think that may be the only reason people are even wanting to leave California to go to Iowa. But here's the rationale behind it. This is the reason that they singled out Iowa as the target of their ire and the reason that they wanted to ensure that their state people didn't go to Iowa. It's about the transgender issue. And by the way, it is not because they have banned women from men's sports and men from women's sports. It's not because they have made any kind of public statement saying that we hate transgenders. It's not that they are refusing to change pronouns on their official government documents or anything like that. This is the really strange part. What California has decided to ban travel to Iowa over is the fact that they refuse to use their state taxpayer money and their Medicaid spending to fund sex change operation surgeries. So the sex change operation, that's the thing that I was like, nope, no taxpayer money is going to go to that. Which makes sense because whether you agree with the transgender movement or not, it's still elective surgery. Show me the transgender person that winds up dying or in medical danger because they do not get transition surgery. And before you go to the high rate of suicide amongst transgenders, because it's ironic we were just talking about suicide and then it gets brought up here, yeah, the rate of suicide doesn't go down after the sex change operation. It remains stagnant. So the idea that that might somehow save somebody's life, that's complete BS. In fact, it's slightly higher. It's not higher enough to make it significant. It's like, I don't know, a tenth of a point last time I was looking at the stats on this. So it's not even a whole percent. But the point is, it stays pretty much level And the transgender surgery, the sex change operation, that doesn't do anything to improve those suicide rates. So that's not even really an argument for doing this. I want you to think of the absurdity of this. Iowa, all they are saying is, you know what? We are not going to use our taxpayer money. And by the way, that surgery is really freaking expensive. We are not going to use our taxpayer's money to pay for some dude to lop off, you know, his stuff. And California is looking at this and going, they're bigots. What kind of world are you living in where that makes you a bigot? Again, even if you're all 100% on board with the transgender movement, that still wouldn't explain why you're in favor of taxpayers paying for it. It doesn't make any sense. Are you going to start paying for plastic surgery now? I mean, let's say that somebody really likes their pet. Are you going to have taxpayer money going for their pet or their Xbox? I mean, what limit is there? I don't understand why this is the straw that breaks the camel's back for California. All Iowa is saying is we're not going to pay for it. Not saying that they can't get the surgery. Just saying we're not going to use our money that the taxpayers have entrusted us with to perform an elective surgery for somebody else. I don't see how that is unreasonable in any way, even if you take the transgender part out of it. I just do not see California's outrage on this. And that brings me to really what the point of all this is. You can't get further from tolerance than what is going on right here. The left can talk about tolerance and being tolerant of one another. This is the opposite of tolerance. This is saying we're so radical that we think anybody that doesn't think you should take money from people to use it for gender reassignment surgery for private citizens is a bigot, and we don't even want to associate with them. None of our tax money will go to a trip inside the state of people that believe that. Isn't saying we don't even want to talk or associate with somebody that shares a different opinion, has a different opinion than we do, isn't that kind of the epitome of being intolerant? The left prides itself on its tolerance, but the truth is, their tolerance is a one-way street. They don't tolerate a difference in ideas. Let's go to the chaplain's report.
In 1775, the Continental Congress created the Chaplain Corps. Under the command of General George Washington, each soldier was required to attend worship service every Sunday. While other armies advanced on their feet, Washington's troops advanced on their knees. It's time for the Chaplain's Report with Caleb Colquitt on tactics.
All right, and our chaplain's report today does come from the book of John. And this is one of my favorite passages in the Gospel of John, and that's saying something because the Gospel of John is my favorite book of the Bible. This is John 3, 26 through 30. And they came to John, by the way, this is John the Baptist, not John the Apostle. And they came to John and said to him, Rabbi, he who is with you beyond the Jordan, to whom you have testified, behold, he is baptizing, and all are coming to him. John answered and said, a man can receive nothing unless it has been given him from heaven. You yourselves are my witnesses, that I said, I am not the Christ, but I have been sent ahead of him. He who has the bride is the bridegroom, but the friend of the bridegroom stands and hears him, rejoices greatly because of the bridegroom's voice. So this joy of mine has been made full. He must increase, but I must decrease. You know, there are so many different places you could go to with that verse. There is such a wealth of theological wisdom contained within them. But I want us to start out at the very beginning of that, where the disciples of John are seeing Jesus really start to increase. His movement is starting to take off. People are actually kind of abandoning them and going to follow Christ. And they are very concerned about this. They're saying, this guy, the one who you baptize, so in their mind, the religious superior, the one doing the baptizing, is the one that this guy who you baptized is sort of taking off and becoming more popular than you. And they see this as a real problem, that these people are going to Christ instead of John. And John is just the epitome of humility here. He answers in such a commanding but yet simple way that he must increase and I must decrease. And I love this analogy that he uses here where he talks about the bride and the bridegroom. It's something that we all understand, that when a wedding is going on, somebody that's a real friend isn't concerned by the fact that they're not the one getting married, or maybe that person doesn't have a wife, or for whatever reason. They understand that the day is not about them. And they're perfectly fine to play whatever role that they do. If you're the best man, you're happy to be the best man. Not because you're happy for yourself or that you get to stand up there, whatever. Frankly, it's much more relaxing just attending a wedding than actually being the best man or being a part of it. And I know that better than most. But you don't feel resentful because the bridegroom or he has the bride. You're thrilled that they're getting married. And that's the same kind of sentiment that John the Baptist says here. John understands he's just a herald. He's just the guy that came to prepare the world for the coming of the Christ. And I mean, oh my gosh, what an honor to be that person that comes to the world and says, the Messiah is coming. He is on his way. Get ready. I mean, I can't imagine what kind of level of honor that is. And with that level of honor, pride could have easily seeped in to John. It could have easily planted a bug in his ear and thought, man, you're a really big deal. Look at you. And I think that's what makes John's humility so impressive. As human beings, we have a hard time dealing with praise and people admiring us and talking well of us. It's hard for someone to have that in their life and to be able to lose it and give it up. That's why you have child stars that their life goes off the rails after they're not quite as popular as they used to be. Heck, even famous people that weren't child stars, if they start kind of going downhill in their career or they're not the name that everybody wants to hear like there once was, they usually have problems with drugs, problems with their mates or illicitly going around and sleeping with people. Their life goes off the rails. They can't handle it when they're not as famous as they once were. And this is John going through this and people talking about him being a prophet and what a great spiritual leader he was. And he was. But this is him seeing his movement moving towards Christ and saying, look, guys, I did my job. This is what I was supposed to do. When at a wedding, the best man kind of steps out of the way to the side to make room for the bride and groom, he doesn't begrudge that. He understands that that's his job. That's what he's there for. His presence is specifically to be an assistant to the person that's actually getting married, the two people that the day is about. And that's exactly what John understood. It wasn't about him. And he got that. With all the temptation, with all the opportunity that John would have had to puff himself up and say, look at me and how, you know, spiritually sound I am and what a great spiritual leader I am. He does the exact opposite. And that's the call that every single disciple of Christ really has, isn't it? That when we give our life to Christ, the first thought in our mind should be, he must increase, I must decrease. His will, his thoughts, his laws, that's what needs to increase in me. And my selfish desires, what I want, needs to decrease. John was so focused on doing the task that God had given him. He was so laser focused on it that he understood that his own fame, his own glory, that's just a side note. It doesn't matter. As long as he got to do what God wanted him to do, he was fine with it. And Jesus, who was his cousin, he understood that that's what the world really needed. As great as John was, and he was, he couldn't save mankind. He wasn't perfect. He didn't have a sinless drop of blood in his body to be able to give as an atonement and save the world. Couldn't do it. He was just glad to be there. He was just glad to tell people the good news that Jesus is coming and salvation is here. And that's what every single one of his disciples should do every single day. And we should go through our day thinking, he must increase. I must decrease. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics is a production of News Radio 1440 and Cumulus Media Montgomery. Any opinions expressed on this program are those of the host and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Cumulus Media. The theme song for Tactics is 6 Foot Town by Big and Rich. Graphics by Jessica Dawson. Broadcast studios provided by Cumulus Media Montgomery. Location studios provided by the Dalreda Church of Christ.